from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll talk with some members of the Icarus Ensemble about their brand new inaugural CD.
I'll get a preview of the play Almost Maine at the Marion University Theater.
And I'll chat with Professor Andrew Levy about his new book on Huck Finn. And we'll have that arts calendar we call...
What do we do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Icarus Ensemble has performed together for more than 7 years, with its members writing original material and selecting arrangements that draw from classical, jazz, and world music forms. Bassist Peter Hansen and pianist Gary Walters joined Sharon Gamble in our studio to talk about and to listen to their first CD, due out on March 8th at a Jazz Kitchen release party.
So tell me about the inspiration for Oopsie Daisy, Gary.
The title Oopsie Daisy actually comes from just a phrase my mom always threw out. Being a good woman she is, she wouldn't use foul language ever. So Oopsie Daisy was, oops, I dropped it, becoming Oopsie Daisy somewhere, and I have no clue what her history of that is. I should ask her someday. But in the meantime, the song I was composing the tune in advance of choosing the title in some respects. But a song in three has a certain A song in three has a certain amount of circular motion in it for me that always invokes things of that nature. And Oopsie Daisy kind of feels that same way to me as a rhythmic word phrase.
Yeah, it's a gentle waltz, and there's some gentleness in the tune that reflects the genteel nature of your mom that you just described.
I didn't describe her as genteel, but thank you.
She's not listening, is she?
Probably not.
We're safe. You had you grew up with other with siblings.
Yes.
Musical household?
In the sense that we were all encouraged to, or allowed, however you want to put it, to participate in school music programs, and I chose, in fact, to take piano lessons as a younger man than that. So our parents were not musicians by profession or even as amateurs, but there was, you know, just always music in the house of some sort or another.
Sure. Yeah. I want to talk to you about the name of your ensemble. Would it be fair to assume that with the name Icarus Ensemble, I might be able to trace back some inspiration to Ralph Towner or Paul Winter Consort or Oregon?
Yeah, you got it. You got it. Yeah, it comes from the Ralph Towner tune where, you know, he takes it from the mythology, I'm sure. But yeah, that was a great tune that we played. Yeah. Actually, Gary plays solo a lot, and we play it as an ensemble. But certainly, Oregon and before that, Paul Winter Consort were inspirations for starting the group.
Sure, and Gary, I looked it up, and your name actually is synonymous with jazz piano in Indianapolis. However, I know that you have classical underpinnings and play a lot of different kinds of music.
Someone needs to fix Google.
Wikipedia. Peter, most people know you from you're still a young man, but from a significant number of years with the ISO. And there is this kind of, what do you call it, cross-training background among the five of you guys. How did you choose these five people to get together? Who got together first? Was it you two and said, I want to write more, I want to do more jazz?
Well,
where did it start?
Peter and I had met via the late, great Chuck Carter. And Chuck Carter was a legendary saxophone player in town, worked with a lot of groups. But I was in a quartet with him, and Peter came as the sub-bass player a couple different times, and Chuck approached us about wanting to do a group that reflected the music of Ralph Towner and those fellows from the Paul Winter Consort in Oregon. And then Chuck passed away and never got a chance to do that, but Peter and I kind of launched the inspiration from that. But as for membership,
well, if anyone that knows those bands, Oregon, it's there's an oboe player, there's a classical guitarist, and there's a bass player.
And a piano. And a piano.
Just Dean and I had, who plays violin in Icarus, Dean and I played a lot of jazz together just as a duo. Ever since he came to the orchestra and moved on to my street. So we did a lot of that. And so Dean seemed like a natural, even though there's no violin in the group Oregon, they did an album with a violinist once. And, just taking an orchestra instrument, traditional orchestra instrument, and putting it
Paul Winter had cellist.
Paul Winter had David Darling and cello. Mm-hmm. Mark kind of lives in the bass room at the ISO with his contrabassoon, and it became pretty clear soon after he joined the orchestra that he was a multi-instrumentalist and also a really enthusiastic jazz player as well. And what he brings to the group with the different instruments is just fantastic. So. The idea is orchestral instruments playing chamber jazz in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to pause for a second here and listen to an excerpt from Better Late Than Never, because I think there's this great transition. This is Dean's tune that starts out with this long, I'm telling you, you know the album better than anyone, but for our audience, long cadenza, kind of referencing Bach and Vivaldi, and then all of a sudden something shifts and boom, we're off to the races. Should be obvious to anybody who was listening carefully that you've got a percussionist among you as well after hearing that. Let's talk about him.
Well, John is in charge, or I forget the official title. He's artist in residence with Butler University as the percussion instructor there, and has been for a number of years, and is a great player, Indianapolis native. And like myself, does a lot of sub work in the Indianapolis Symphony. Now, John is invited to come for the ISO's concerts, both in classical and pops, and is very busy as a performer with them in addition to his teaching duties. I'm kind of more narrowly invited to come and be the pops pianist for the symphony, which I love and enjoy doing that. So in a sense, everybody in the group participates in the ISO, and John also, of course, with all his orchestral experience, is able to bring different colors to the percussion section than than what some traditional drum set players might have chosen to do.
Sure. Now, it's not as though any of you didn't have enough to do before adding Icarus to the portfolio. What does this add to the rest of your musical life, Peter?
It allows me to write, create pieces, and just know they're going to be played expertly by these guys. They're very welcoming for new works, and just to get to hear them and have a sound in your head, and just to be able to hear it manifested by these great players. That's it's not a hardship at all to be to make time for writing and for then rehearsing and performing with these guys. It's a joy.
And for me, because a lot of my writing has been previously in the jazz genre and even in the pop genre, it's been great because with the fine level of musicianship these guys have as a result of their symphony work, I've been able to do more what is referred to as through composing. That is, lots and lots of notes can be on the page, and these guys say, yeah, so no big deal. I can play those. And so I can be very specific about my vision for a piece of music and have sections of it be broadly open for improvisation, et cetera.
That's a big question I had, was how much room do you leave when you're writing?
Yeah. When I first started writing with the group, I probably put in more room for that and realized that actually if I was going to take full advantage of the skills here and the talents, my better move was to force more specific written information on the page, which has resulted in what I consider to be some wonderful performing of some of my things that I had in my head. So it's been great.
That's an evolution in terms of writing, I think, as Gary alludes to. The more you write and the more you hear what the other guys do, mm-hmm. the more you realize, oh, man, this guy's strengths are this.
And, right.
And you write to that. Not, you know, everyone does everything really well, but there are certain things that are just stick out, you know, for you.
Chess. Mm-hmm. So you're listening one day and you go, oh, that's a really sweet spot. That guy's really strong in that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and I just think back to our very first concert down at U of I in 2007, a piece I'd written, a very short piece, but just the voicings that Gary did on it were just, you know, really, really special. And you know, that's just, you know, that continues to be the thing that really draws me about, you know, about hearing what he does with my works and all our works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did you decide on the repertoire to go on your first, very first album?
You got a huge repertoire.
Yeah. Was there?
No. We really did, you know, we could have
done a double CD.
Yeah, well, we could have done a double CD. We could have even done a lot of material that is not original material, because we have a batch of things that are from the Beatles, a few classical pieces, and a few other things that we've written arrangements of. They're very special arrangements that a lot of our fans love to hear us do. But we thought, well, the first album, the first time out, the first thing we're ever going to do, we should showcase all of our talents. And that, in our minds, meant let's narrow down the compositions. And so Peter has a lot more compositions that are on there, as do I, and as does Mark, and as will Dean. But in the meantime, I think each of us chose what we thought were our strongest tunes.
Sure.
As composers.
Yeah, I think it was hard to narrow it down to 12, but...
Leave them wanting more?
Yeah, right. Yeah. 12 even seems like it could be a bit much, but...
Yeah.
But it's very representative of what we've done over the last 8 years. Definitely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
& Gamble with bassist Peter Hansen and pianist Gary Walters. Their first CD will debut at a release party at 7 p.m. on Sunday, March 8th at the Jazz Kitchen. Learn more by searching Icarus Ensemble on Facebook or visit thejazzkitchen.com. Again, Icarus Ensemble or thejazzkitchen.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. The town of Almost, Maine is the setting for a midwinter night's dream of a play where love comes in as many colors as the northern lights. Travis DiNicola spoke with Ben Tebbe, director of Marion University Theater, and with theater student Sarah Hunter about their production.
Sarah, Ben, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to see you, too.
Thank you so much. So great to be here.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome. Ben, let's start with you as the director of Marion University Theater, a role that you've had for 3 years now.
About that, somewhere in there.
Yeah. Tell me about, so what's going on at Marion University in terms of the theater program?
There are a lot of exciting things happening at Marion University. The university itself is just growing tremendously, and the theater program is undergoing a bit of a resurgence as well.
Mm-hmm.
We actually lost one of our theaters last summer. We used to perform.
You misplaced it?
No, well, that'd be hard to do.
Yeah.
We used to perform almost exclusively in our Black Box Theater,
mm-hmm.
and there was a fire in that building about a year ago
last February,
and so we had to tear down that building over the summer.
Oh,
and,
sorry to hear that.
It's kind of sad, but on the other hand, it allows us to now move our sort of full-time program over to our state-of-the-art Marion University Theater, former home of Civic Theater.
Right.
So it's a 500 seat proscenium theater. It's a beautiful, renovated in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a wonderful space to perform in. And so we're really excited about being in there. We have some exciting new theater scholarships to offer incoming students. So
mm-hmm.
if they're part of our program, we can provide some financial assistance to having them be part of our program, and so it's a really exciting time. We're growing. We have a lot of student involvement, and it's exciting.
That's excellent. And the program right now, it is just people can get a minor in it.
That's correct.
They can't major in it yet, but they can minor in it.
That's right.
But how many students do you have that are minoring in the program right now?
We have about 8 minors currently,
mm-hmm.
but like I said, since we are doing a lot more recruiting, we have a scholarship now available, we could easily double that number by next year.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Good. And I imagine you have a lot of students who participate in it who aren't minors.
And absolutely. That's one of the nice things about going to a small school is that opportunity to get involved in
sure.
all kinds of programs. And you don't have to be a major or a minor in something to be involved. And we always encourage students of any major or minor to come play with us.
Is there a particular emphasis in the studies in terms of performance or tech or musical theater or any type of theater history? It's more of a general program,
more
right?
of a general program, yeah. It's the education is largely based on acting, a lot of backstage work, and
mm-hmm.
just doing the productions themselves. So it's very hands-on. It's more of a general program and not specifically performance geared or
right.
backstage gear or anything like that.
Well, you're really fortunate that, the theater that you're in, as you mentioned, is where Civic used to be for a number of years, and that is such a great space.
Beautiful.
And, for a smaller university to have a theater of that caliber is really
mm-hmm.
kind of excellent for your students.
It's wonderful. I mean, and it's a great place for an audience to
mm-hmm.
sit and enjoy a show.
Yeah, really comfortable space
yeah.
and all that. And looking forward to seeing the next show you have coming up. Almost Maine. Almost is the name of a small town in Maine.
Yes, fictitious town.
Fictitious town. Great name. As someone who spent some time in Maine, I kind of already have a vision of it.
Yeah.
But this sounds, it's a real sort of farcical play, a midwinter's comedy type of
mm-hmm.
Love story in this cold, small town, northern lights ablaze.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean,
I kind of call it sort of magical realism.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, in some ways, a very realistic play, and certainly the themes of love and heartache and all of those things that we all go through
mm-hmm.
are universal, do make it very real. But there's this magical element to it since the Northern Lights are there and it's in this fictitious town, there's this magical element You know, the Northern Lights, the player talked about, you know, happen when atoms get excited.
And so magnetized and charged.
And he talks about that these residents are, you know, normally very grounded people who find themselves falling in and out of love in unexpected ways because we're watching them in those excited moments.
So it really is kind of the Northern Lights that instigate things.
Exactly.
Cool. Yeah. Sarah, I want to hear about your role in this. Your character is named Glory, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about your character.
Yeah, Glory actually has a really big connection to the Northern Lights, in fact. She starts off the show, and so she comes up to Almost Maine to kind of deal with a recent death in her life.
Mm-hmm.
And her connection to the Northern Lights is what she's using to reconcile that death. She's using it to kind of move on, to say her last goodbyes to this person. And in the course of time, when she comes to Almost Maine, she's actually a hiker, and so she hikes up there all by herself and then proceeds to camp out in a stranger's yard without asking for his permission for it. And so she ends up meeting the man whose yard she has promptly parked herself in.
Uh-huh.
And so she ends up talking with him and sharing her story with him a little bit. And then he comes to get to know the person that she is, the connections that she has to this person that she's lost, and her rationale and her reason behind why she's here and why she came all the way up to Maine to see the Northern Lights to say goodbye to someone. So it's a really, she deals a lot with that magical aspect of Almost Maine. And she starts off the show. It's one of the first scenes in the show, so it kind of gets the ball rolling a lot.
No, this is a play that has a lot of characters, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And multiple scenes and sort of vignettes following different people as they're dealing with their lives in Almost Maine.
Right. We meet. There are sort of nine scenes, so we meet about 18, 19 residents of Almost Maine throughout the course of the evening. We have. In the nine scenes, we have 13 actors. It was actually written for four actors.
Okay.
And to be, you know, that everyone would play multiple characters. But that's one of the great things about the show is that it's very flexible. And so I was able to cast more students.
Actually, it sounds like a great piece for a university production just because you can.
It is.
You know,
it has that flexibility.
No one necessarily has to carry the whole thing for a couple hours. Everyone gets some experience and exposure. And
exactly.
Very cool. Yeah. So it sounds just like a ton of fun. I can't help but imagine. I'm not trying to be your set designer here, or your lighting designer. But I mean, it sounds as though the Northern Lights are really kind of a character.
They are absolutely.
And, I mean, do we expect to see them
somehow
on stage?
We will see them. Yeah. In fact, another great thing about you know, when I came back to Marion, I you know had a long. Well, not a super long career, but I had a career as a professional actor here in town, too. So
absolutely.
I had a lot of connections.
Phoenix Theater.
Phoenix, IRT, and other places, Heartland Actors. One of the things I'm trying to bring back to the program is a connection to the professional world here in Indianapolis. And so David Lapham, who's a professional lighting designer, is actually coming in to design our lights for us for this show.
That's very
cool. So, yeah. We will see the Northern Lights. I'm very sure of it.
Excellent. Any moose up there or maple syrup or...
There's still time.
There's still time. I'm just imagining like any like research you had to do on Maine or anything like that. Sarah, in working on your character, have you been to Maine before?
I have not been to Maine. No, I'm actually originally from Ohio, so that's about as far away from here as I've gone.
Yeah. Well, tell me about so you're a minor in the theater program at Marion and a sophomore. Tell me about why you chose to be a part of the program and what you've been able to do since you've been a part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely love the opportunities that the theater program at Marion has been able to give me. I'm also majoring in my actual major is in education and my minor is in theater. So I'm getting to do kind of both of my loves. That's one of the reasons that really drew me to Marion.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really cool because I'm originally from Toledo, Ohio, and no one in Toledo has ever heard of Marion or anything like that. So I did a lot of research and ended up finding Marion and just really falling in love with the program. A lot of larger schools you'll find have very big, prestigious theater programs and everything, but they kind of lose that family atmosphere that I really, really like in the theater. People that the theater department brings people together. They create friendships and bonds that helps to build characters and builds compassion and understanding between the people that are working in the program. So Marion's program really enabled me to be able to do everything that I love about the theater. And one of the things that I really like about the program is the fact that it doesn't just focus on one particular area. It's not just technical theater. It's not just acting. We literally get to try everything. Working here at the theater, I not only get to perform, I was in Songs for a New World last semester at Marion, where I got to sing on stage, which was really fun. But I also work as a crew member at the theater, so I get to work with all these different types of theater groups that come in and out of the theater. I got to meet some fantastically talented people.
Sure, because you guys have a lot of touring shows that come through as well.
Definitely. And just getting even to network with those people, talk to them, ask for their experiences, get a little advice here and there about what they enjoy from the programs. So I get to work with tons of different awesome people, but also working with Ben and getting to hear his professional experience, kind of getting me out there into the world of professional auditions. I actually had my first professional audition a couple months ago, which was really exciting.
Very proud
so,
of him.
So yeah, so that was really, really exciting for me too. So again, and this is way beyond the, I've made leaps and bounds since I was in high school as far as the types of things I've been able to do, the experiences that I've had, and I've grown so much as a person mainly because of this program. It's
That's
just
great to
changed
hear.
Me so much.
Mm-hmm. Excellent, excellent. Good. I'm so glad it's been working out for you.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So your parents are coming in from Ohio, I'm guessing, to see your show?
I believe so, yeah. I hope so. Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
If the weather holds up.
Now, Ben, for Almost Maine, that's coming up. You guys have a couple of performances on February 27th and 28th at the University Theater.
Right.
You also have a show coming up in March, right around St. Patrick's Day, is that right?
Yeah. So we have Eunan McIntyre, who is 100% Irish, direct from County Donegal in Ireland. He'll be back. We actually had him last year as well around St. Patrick's Day. And so he'll be back again this year to do a family-friendly concert on Saturday, March 21st at 3 p.m.,
Nice.
So people should come check that out as well. Absolutely. He's a wonderful singer-songwriter. There'll be a lot of traditional Irish music as well as some of his award-winning music as well. So
very cool.
It'll be a fun afternoon.
Very good. Hey, before we wrap things up, anything else you want to say about Almost Maine, the next play that you guys have coming up? I mean, it just sounds like we were talking before we went on the air. I had not really heard of the play much before. It's been around since about 2004, and it just sounds like just a really fun, delightful script. I'm looking forward to checking it out.
It is a delightful script. I mean, that's a perfect word for it. It's a lot of the scenes are very funny. Some of the scenes can be a little bit heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's the full range. And it deals with love. So it's universal. We've all gone through many of these circumstances in our own lives. Maybe not in the exact same sort of magical way that happens on stage in Almost Maine. But it's delightful. It's a charming, charming play that'll have you laughing and crying at the same time. So,
excellent.
I hope people come out and see it. What's interesting is just last year, the playwright himself revived it in New York City. So it's had a long, there have been over 2,000 productions across the country since it premiered 10 years ago.
But first time here in Indianapolis.
It might have been at a high school. Okay. So,
close enough.
Okay. We'll say it.
Well, Ben, Sarah, great to have you both in for talking about Marion University Theater here on Art of the Matter. Great to have you both in. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Travis DiNicola with Ben Tebbe, director of Marion University Theater, and theater student Sarah Hunter. The Marion University Department of Theater production of Almost Maine takes place on February 27th and 28th at 7 p.m. at the University Theater on Cold Spring Road. For more information, visit marion.edu/theater. And remember, Marion is M-A-R-I-A-N, so marion.edu/theater. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
What did you give up for Lent?
What did I give up for Lent?
Mm-hmm.
It was not going to arts events, I'll tell you that.
Good answer, because we have some things to do to fill up your time or your urges, depending on what you gave up for Lent. On our calendar, we call What Will We Do?
In fact, that's what I gave up for Lent, is not going to things.
Oh, wow. That's complicated.
So, yeah, encourage people to get out and do something.
Quick, get out Martha and Graham from Away with Words, and we need to parse that sentence.
Hey, well, a really fun thing to do this weekend is to check out the Poetry Out Loud Indiana State Finals competition. This is through the Indiana Arts Commission, and high school students from across the state are going to be taking place in this competition on the 21st at the Public Library, Central Library downtown, and it begins at 10:30 a.m., and the public is invited. This is the 10th anniversary for both the state and national competitions, and this is a really cool program where the state champion actually receives a $200 cash prize and a trip to D.C. to compete in the national finals. But basically what they're doing is it's open to any student in Indiana schools, and they are reading poetry out loud. And it's, so it's encouraging kids to study and learn and read great poetry. So there should be some really good performances going on starting at 10:30 at the Central Library on Saturday.
Indeed. So, back in the day, a fellow in a disguise wearing a mask turned up in Mozart's residence and commissioned him to write the famous Requiem. So Encore Vocal Arts is doing a performance this Saturday night at 7 o'clock at Indiana Landmark Center in the Grand Hall, and the audience is invited to emulate this mysterious fellow who commissioned the Requiem by dressing in black and wearing a mask. It's a little bit like channeling Mardi Gras a few days later.
No, okay, I was thinking Batman, but sure, but Mardi Gras sounds good too.
So it's a full evening of events with a pre-party and an after-party, and you can find out more at encorevocalarts.org. So if going to hear the Mozart Requiem sung by a fabulous ensemble isn't enough for you, there's other stuff that night as well. Encorevocalarts.org for more information about that Saturday night performance.
Very good. Well, while the children are away, the adults will play. It's the Adult Swim. The third annual Adult Swim is this Saturday night at the Children's Museum, presented by the Children's Museum and Sapphire Theater Company. And it is a fun time for all those people who've said, boy, the Children's Museum would be great if there just weren't any kids here.
Well, pesky children underfoot.
So they're going to have dinosaurs and DJs and drinks and dancing and oh my, and lots of great food and lots of great fun, and you can check out all the cool exhibits and enjoy a twilight ride in the carousel and all sorts of things. Remember to bring your photo ID because it is 21 and older, not younger. This is for adults, and so this is gonna be a lot of fun. Tickets are moving very, very fast, so make sure you get them now. Check out thechildrensmuseum.org for more information for Adult Swim Saturday night.
Yeah, I double dare you to try to figure out the water clock without a kid there to explain
Ouch.
It to you. Hey, the Greater Indianapolis Flute Club is welcoming international flute star Jasmine Choi. She's headlining the 2015 Flute Fest on Saturday, March 7th, coming up very soon, a couple weeks, at Butler's Schrott Center for the Arts. The day features a full slate of workshops on fit flute, new music, audition prep, a masterclass with Jasmine Choi, and a flute choir reading session. Registration starts at 7:45. The first session starts at 9. Wide array of exhibitors, so if you're looking for a new instrument or other accessories or what have you, you've got a great variety there. And the day culminates with a recital at 7 o'clock. That's 7 in the evening by Jasmine Choi, performing music of Telemann, Schumann, Ian Clark, Paul Schoenfeld, Schubert, and Vittorio Monti. It's all coming up on Saturday, March 7th, calling everyone who plays flute.
Sounds good. A flute fest.
A flute fest.
If you will. Coming up on Friday, February 27th, at Indiana Landmark Center, Billy Myers, who's a great jazz musician himself, bass player, is producing an evening of jazz performance, a celebration in song to celebrate the birthday of Cynthia Lane, who just passed recently. Cynthia was an incredible jazz singer, and this concert is a fundraiser for the Cynthia Lane Memorial Fund, and they're going to have some wonderful jazz performers, all of whom had performed with Cynthia at different times. Greg Bacon, Brenda Williams, Jimmy Guilford, Kellyn Strutz, Jan Aldridge Clark, Jared Thompson, Pavel, Keith Hayes, and a special guest of Angela Brown is going to be there as well. This is going to be an absolute fantastic show, worth checking out, and a great way to celebrate the life and sounds of Cynthia Lane. So again, this is on Friday, February 27th at Indiana Landmarks. And if you search Eventbrite for Cynthia Lane, you can find more information or go online as well on Facebook and stuff.
Excellent. Hey, maybe you didn't get all of your Valentine's celebrating done a week or so ago. You can still go to the Love, Lust, and Poetry exhibit at Nickel Plates Arts up in Noblesville. That goes through February 28th. It features artwork from local artists that evoke a feeling of love, inspire a sense of lust, or embrace poetic sentiments, or maybe all three. Admission to the gallery is free, and you can find more by Googling Nickel Plate Arts.
Sounds good. Well, Sharon, you can always learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide website. Or you can just listen to us next week on that calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Ever wonder why we still read The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn? Butler University's Edna Cooper Chair in English, Andrew Levy, suggests a number of reasons in his new book, Huck Finn's America, Mark Twain and the Era That Shaped His Masterpiece. The New York Times calls it a capacious and companionable study of the novel. And Sharon Gamble invited Dr. Levy in to tell us more.
So here's where I'd like to start. I'm going to read you a line from more or less the middle of this book. Huck Finn was a bomb thrown straight into a national debate that has never exactly receded, only transformed to recognize new technologies. That's kind of the thesis of the book. How did you first come to Huck Finn? And then how did you, presumably some number of years later, start to think more about what it is and what it isn't?
Well, first, that's a fantastic pull quote, Sharon. Thanks. For, it's one of my favorites, too. I came to it like most people do. You know, in my teens, I read it in school, and I read it again in school. During the 70s and 80s, in fact, I think there are statistics showing that it was mandatory reading in as many as 70 or 75% of all American schools. So it was really a kind of almost universal reading experience. But I actually didn't bond with the book when I was a kid. I bonded with it later, in my 20s and 30s. Russell Baker, the great late columnist for the New York Times, once said that Huck Finn is best appreciated only by people who are over the age of 25, and then ideally only over the age of 35. And even then, they need to have a large experience of American culture to get it. And I'm a little closer to one of those kinds of readers, I would say, although I think children can get special things out of the book. What I'm referring to in that quote is specifically the debate about children and how to raise them. And there's this sort of article of faith about Huck Finn that it's about how wonderful and innocent and carefree childhood used to be, that it was all about walking around in your bare feet and a fishing pole and being out in nature a lot. And all those things do take place in the book. But in the 1870s and 1880s, when Twain wrote it and when it was published, there was an enormous national debate about juvenile delinquency, about compulsory education. They were very worried about children in gangs. They're very worried about children in popular culture, although at the time their popular culture were things like dime novels, not video games, but it was very much a similar debate.
As you say, different technology, but same principle.
Exactly, exactly. And the same argument. They were worried that they had no control over their kids, what they were reading, that they were reading coarse, violent material that was making their kids coarse and violent. We have the same argument today. And Twain was throwing that bomb into that debate. Huck Finn, that character specifically, was a response to a lot of the stereotypes and a lot of the arguments about American children at the time.
We sometimes have this idealized version of how novels or any works of art come to be, that a composer sits down and writes a full-blown symphony or that a novelist sits down and just writes for 6 months and is done. But Twain really, this really percolated for a long time in his mind.
Yeah, he had a way of leaving a lot of unfinished manuscripts around, and he'd finish some of them and not others. So he really, he starts Huck Finn in 1876 in the summer on vacation, and even then he thinks very little of it. And he puts it down, and he picks it up in bits and pieces in 1880, 1881. But he doesn't really commit to it till 1883 and 1884. So it's about a eight or nine-year gestation period.
And meanwhile, he becomes a father to children who are wildly different from one another.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, I think this is something that's really been missed in this discussion, which is that at the exact same time he's writing Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer as well, he's raising three children of his own. They're daughters, and they're, you know, unlike Huck and Tom, you know, he's raising them in Connecticut in a fancy house where he's taking them to Europe. They learn German before they learn English, in fact.
And they teach themselves English,
essentially. And something that Twain was proud of. He and his wife, Olivia, actually forbade them books in English. And they stole books and learned, taught themselves to read. And I think that really says a lot about Mark Twain. He was so proud of them for biting at the forbidden food and for teaching themselves, frankly. He thought kids could be tremendous autodidacts.
And we have to, one way in which that time is a little different from this, just a little different, is that there were still pretty strictly prescribed gender roles. So there had to have been some part of him that was like, oh, there's a little boy inside my little girl for being so sassy and naughty.
I think that, you know, the gender roles were obviously more prescribed than today. At the same time, there was porousness. There were ways that, you know, boys read girls' books, girls read boys' books. They put on, you know, theatrical productions where his kids would play the prince and the pauper's daughters. So there were moments which were available. But if you go through his notes about his own kids, you'll see a lot of stuff very close to what Huck says from his own daughters. And I think because they were daughters and because Huck and Tom are such iconic boys and because the boys are poor, middle class from Missouri and the girls are these sort of prim Victorian ideals, theoretically, we never make the connection. But
sure.
You read his notes about his own children and you read Huck Finn and you just can't miss it.
And parenthood is parenthood no matter what era. And it's I've always been fascinated through reading Mark Twain's own work through the years. The role he has assigned to his wife, you know, she's his ultimate editor and she's kind of his conscience and so forth. But with this book, it's such an interesting portal into that family life as well. And he wants to be a dad and he knows he should be more of a disciplinarian, but he kind of steps into and out of those roles, which I know lots of contemporary parents struggle with, whether they're moms or dads. It's like, who has to be the bad guy and who's responsible for the rules?
Yeah, I think you're really right, Sharon, that, he just, he couldn't, you know, parents are ambivalent, you know, there's very few parents that are straight disciplinarians, always in control, and there's very few that are completely permissive. And Twain really bopped back and forth, and you can see how little heart he has for the disciplinarian. But he's kind of caught in this interesting battle of wills, a very friendly, genial battle of wills with both his wife and his children about who's who in this family.
Right.
And you can see sometimes he's sort of taking the kid's side, you know. His youngest daughter misbehaves and he thinks I should spank her, but instead we just hang out and watch the cows for an afternoon. I let her win and I'm happier letting her win than lose.
And that ambivalence crosses over into the writing, too.
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think that, you know, it's hard, you know, when you read Huck Finn, I really think that, and I don't think people have looked at it this way enough. They see it as a children's book for children.
Yeah.
I see it as more of a book for parents. It's written with a parent's love, but it's also written with a parent's conflicts. Until, you know, you really feel, you know, once you read what he wrote about his own children, you feel all that love, all that desire to protect Huck. Channeled through, but you also feel like, you know, sometimes he's putting Huck in his place and reminding him who's who.
And there might be also, if you elevate that role right there to what is society's role in the raising of children, which, as we just said, hasn't, this debate continues, but there might have been in that era a theory that we don't hold anymore. You know, we sometimes hear about how, you know, children should be seen and not heard was the rule back then. But tell us a little bit about this idea of children's development paralleling human development.
There was a very current popular historical belief in the Victorian era. It's called, you know, the recapitulation principle, or ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. It's not easy to pronounce on radio.
I hope it goes by an acronym.
And what it basically means is that the history of the race, the human race, is repeated in the history of every child or every human in it, so that, you know, primitive, so-called primitive races are like children, and then races and cultures and countries grow into teenagerhood, and then they grow into adulthood. And a lot of people believe this. And it was kind of taken for granted in the way they regarded children and how they thought children should be raised. They understood that children might have a period of, you know, wildness, but they associated it again with so-called primitive races, which means it was incredibly easy for them to suggest that children and African Americans, for instance, were on the same intellectual level. But Twain was not like that. Twain clearly believed that history did not go all one way. And likewise, I think he believed that children didn't necessarily grow and mature, but in some ways they were already mature. But that the idea that there's only adult behavior and there's only children behavior, child behavior, was completely not on his radar. He really thought it was more of a blend or a blur. And in that way, that also carried over to his beliefs on race.
He had such such adeptness at studying language, cadence, pronunciation, and he, you know, he was essentially an ethnologist, collecting and writing down scraps and snippets and recapitulating songs.
Oh, he adored language. I mean, everyone's language, everything from Shakespeare to the sailors swearing, as he said himself. And he loved mimicking it. He loved memorizing it. He loved writing it down in his journals. His journals are, as you say, just filled with song snippets. He would talk stories out before he wrote them down. And he was really committed to getting inside other people's voices. There's a great story from late in his life where Helen Keller, who would sometimes listen to people by putting her hand on their throat, put her hand on his throat as he talked, and she was like agog. She said, "This guy's different. There's something really extraordinary about his voice."
He had a particular fascination for the minstrel show.
Yeah, and that's a tricky and complicated part of this book and this story.
Yeah.
And I could take the rest of several interviews explaining it, but essentially the minstrel show was probably, and we underestimate this, the most popular form of American entertainment in that century. It was created and expressed a lot of social noise. I think we tend to think of it as exclusively a genre for transmitting negative stereotypes about African Americans, and it was that, and in many ways worse than we remember, but it was also a place to transmit a lot of other negative stereotypes about women, Jews, Germans, Chinese. It was also a place to transmit positive, potentially subversive, in certain locations, beliefs about race and identity. And there were so many minstrels that you could kind of pick and choose the way now someone might like one rock star but not another. Twain was completely enamored of the minstrel show. He fell in love with it when he was a kid. He created a lot of distance from it during other parts of his life, but even at the end of his life, he still said, it's the show without peer. And the question is, what does that mean? And I think that it's the biggest criticism of Twain I make in this book. And I won't, you know, is that he really felt that black culture was his to appropriate, to use as he sees fit, and that that's something he got from the minstrel show, and that that still bleeds through Huckleberry Finn in a way we ought to come to grips with now if we want to talk about and teach this book properly. But the minstrel show was also the only place in popular American culture where race was regarded as a joke, as a put-on, as a falsehood. And Twain liked that part of it, too. He liked the instability. He really deep down believed that race was a joke and a cruel joke, and that this was the only place that honored that belief as well. So it's a complicated, ambivalent relationship.
Sharon Gamble with Andrew Levy. Dr. Levy is Butler University's Edna Cooper Chair in English. His new book, Huck Finn's America, Mark Twain and the Era That Shaped His Masterpiece, is published by Simon & Schuster and available widely.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll have a special extended interview with Maestro Krzysztof Urbanski.
I'll find out about Marcus May and a new play he's written, and we'll have that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.